This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Senator Al Franken. He's written a new memoir. Unlike the satirical political memoir he wrote years ago, this one's for real, but it's still very funny. It's called Al Franken, Giant of the Senate. Being funny as a senator is kind of new for him. He spent his first term trying not to be funny in order to convince voters and Congress that he was serious about his job. Franken was a writer and performer on Saturday Night Live from its start in 1975 through 1980. He rejoined the show 5 years later and stayed through 1995. He's written several books of political satire and hosted a show on the progressive radio network Air America. He was first elected senator from Minnesota in 2008. He won after an 8-month recount and legal battle. He was reelected in 2014. I've interviewed him at several different stages of his life. Senator Al Franken, welcome to Fresh Air. In all the years I've interviewed you, this is the first time I get to call you Senator. I've been interviewing you since you were a writer and performer on Saturday Night Live, back in the 80s, maybe even as far as the 70s. And I confess, when you announced that you were running for the Senate, I thought maybe you were doing it so that you'd have a great political satirical book to write when you lost. That's a terrible thing to say. But was I part of your problem? Because I know you had trouble having people.
I'd always say during the campaign, that Terry goes. No, there was sort of that problem, which is we had one sort of, the go-to guy on politics in Minnesota, Larry Jacobs, who's actually going to be interviewing me for this book soon. And his whole, he finally, like a year in, was convinced I was serious about this. But no, I had to overcome sort of a lot of that. Yeah.
I knew that you were very politically serious. I'd heard you do your explainers to Howard Stern and on Air America. But is this a turning point for you? Does this book say that you feel safe now writing a memoir that's both really funny and also really serious about politics and forthcoming, or at least partially forthcoming, about your life?
Well, yeah. What happened was the first time out, I won by 312 votes. Percentage-wise, the narrowest margin ever in the history of the Senate elections. And I needed to prove to Minnesotans, because the campaign had been pretty ugly and they had used a lot of material that I had written or said during my 35, 40 years as a comedian and put it through this $15 million machine called the Dehumorizer, which would take all the irony and context out of anything I'd said and come at the end being very offensive. So I had to prove to people that I was serious and that I was serious about doing this job for the people of Minnesota and doing what Paul Wellstone, who held the seat before me and who died less than two weeks before the 2002 election, he said that politics is not about power, it's not about money, it's not about winning for the sake of winning, it's about improving people's lives. And so I set out to prove that's what I was doing. And it wasn't until I won 6 years later by a very comfortable margin that I said, okay, I can be funny again. I can be funny again.
So you write in the book that after devoting your life to learning how to be funny, you had to learn not to be funny once you got into politics. Was there an example of how you sabotaged yourself by being funny?
When I first started out this, I went to Paul Wellstone's campaign manager and sat down with him and had coffee. And he said, write a 5-minute speech that has no jokes in it. And I went, why would anyone do that? And he was saying, you've got to prove to people you're serious. This is early, very early on. This is in 2005. And that's the way I had expressed myself and through satire. But yeah, I sabotaged myself early. Oh, I remember one time I was very proud of myself for not doing the joke. I was in New Ulm, Minnesota, which is a beautiful town that was founded by German settlers. That's why it's called New Ulm. And they have this big statue in their park called Herman the German. And he stands on like a 75-foot pedestal. And he's a statue to a Arminius who defeated a Roman army killed a lot of Romans in the year 9 when Jesus was just a tot. And I grew up in St. Louis Park, which is kind of the Jewish suburb of Minneapolis. It's called St. Jewish Park by people. And so I wanted, it popped in my head is like, oh, this statue is called Herman the German. And that's how it's known. And I wanted to say, you know, in St. Louis Park, we had a little statue called Stu the Jew. And I didn't do it. And my team was so proud of me after I told them I didn't do this. And then, like, a week later, New York Magazine comes out and goes, like, has there ever been a joke you thought of and didn't tell? Yeah. Yeah. And then I tell Stu the Jew. And and they're going, like, why did you do that? Why didn't you just say, I can't remember one? And I write about that in the book, and it's about pivoting, learning the basic pivoting. You've probably experienced
that. Oh, my God, I hate it when politicians pivot. Well, you ask a question, and you get a pre-planned answer to the question that you didn't ask.
But the good ones
are good at pivoting. So you get the talking point that the politician wanted to put out instead of an answer to your question. And you say in your book that you had to learn how to pivot, even though you hate to pivot. So what is it like to have to do something in interviews that you used to call that stuff out, you know, as a satirist?
Exactly.
And then you have to do it yourself.
See, the reason they give you the talking point.
You better answer my question.
I'll answer your question.
Okay.
But the reason you do that is actually you do want to get the message out that you want to get out that day.
Mm-hmm.
It's strategic. And that's why your communications team tells you, you know, today you're about talking about the terrible Republican health care bill. And so if they ask me, why are you 20 points down to your opponent? People in Minnesota don't care about polls. What they care about is the health care bill. that's a pivot, right?
Right.
So it took me forever to learn that. And it's because I think I'm a very literal person, and I think my parents just taught me if someone asks you a question, answer the question. And so what I would do is answer questions, and then I'd go on about it, and invariably whatever was on the news or whatever was on the radio or whatever was on in the newspaper was not our strategic objective. So I had to learn that.
So continuing the idea of how your humor could be used against you, you have a great example in the book about a sketch you did for Saturday Night Live that involved a bestiality joke.
This was in the Playboy article.
It was in the Playboy article, right, okay.
Basically, I'd written an article for Playboy that was used against me, and in one part of it, I'm talking about the benefits of new technology. And I say, for the example, the internet is a great, great learning tool. My son did a great sixth grade report last year on bestiality. He downloaded a lot of great visual aids from the internet, and the kids in the class just loved them because, you know, at that age, they're just sponges. Now, that is a very conservative joke because the joke is saying, parents, watch what your kids are getting on the internet, right? So they use this in an ad where they're going like, Al Franken talks about bestiality, and it kind of comes zooms in at you. And that one made my mother-in-law cry.
Literally?
Literally made her cry. A lot about the campaign made her cry. It was a vicious, vicious campaign.
Okay, so what do you do in a situation like that? You're making a joke about how parents should really be careful what their kids do on the internet, how they should monitor it. And as an example, you use it, you know, access to porn and bestiality. It's totally taken out of context, totally used against you. How do you fight back against something like that?
Well, I learned something, which is you can't litigate comedy. You can't litigate a joke.
Mm-hmm.
And in politics, when you're explaining, you're losing. So I had to let that go. And that was hard for me because I'm very proud of my career in comedy. And I had to just, at a certain point, I mean, I tried, I learned it by trying to litigate jokes. And it just, you can't do it. You got to let go.
So you've become known as a very forceful questioner during confirmation hearings, the confirmation hearings of Betsy DeVos, Neil Gorsuch, Jeff Sessions. And I want to play what might be the most famous question that you've asked, and this is to Jeff Sessions during his confirmation hearings to become attorney general. And you were asking him about how he'd handle it if people in the Trump campaign were found to have had contact with Russian officials. So here's that clip.
And if there is any evidence that anyone affiliated with the Trump campaign communicated with the Russian government in the course of this campaign, what will you do?
Senator Franken, I'm not aware of any of those activities. I have been called a surrogate at a time or two in that campaign, and I did not have communications with the Russians, and I'm unable to comment on it.
Okay, what did you expect he might answer, and how did you react to the answer he gave?
Well, I was basically saying, would you recuse yourself if you're attorney general? And it turned out that the Trump campaign was under investigation for this. And he pivoted. I think that he didn't want to talk about whether he'd recuse himself. And so I think he pivoted to the answer he had prepared, saying I did not have any contact with the Russians, which, of course, turned out not to be true.
Yes, he really, he may have maybe incriminated is too strong a word, but
well, he was under oath, so.
Yeah, he didn't tell the truth. I mean, we now know that he had at least two meetings with the Russian ambassador, Sergei Kislyak, in 2016, and he didn't disclose that not only to you, but when he applied for his security clearance, he didn't disclose that either.
That's right.
So do you feel like there have been consequences for Jeff Sessions for the answer that he gave you at the confirmation hearings?
Well, once it came out that he did have contact with Kislyak, the ambassador, he then did recuse himself, which was kind of the point of my question. Because he recused himself, Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general, was able to appoint a special prosecutor, Bob Mueller, who is a very good prosecutor. So I've been credited with that because I asked that the question I asked. But he answered a different question. He answered a question that he, you know, I was accused by Chuck Grassley, who I admire a lot, who is the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, of asking him a gotcha question. But actually, he asked himself the gotcha question, which was his invented question was, have you had contact with the Russians? And he answered it falsely. But people give me tremendous credit for all this. And it's like Franken knew exactly what he was doing. He's playing three-dimensional chess. And he's obviously four moves ahead of everybody else. And no, I was just asking him, would you recuse yourself? And I think he pivoted to not answer that question.
Have you spoken to him about that since the confirmation?
No, I haven't. And I expect I will. But maybe not about that particularly, but about other matters.
So does an encounter like that change your relationship?
Yes, I would think it. I don't know. As I say, I haven't talked to him since then. And we were friends. We were friendly. And Mary, his wife, and my wife were friends on, there's a thing called the Spouse Club. And Mary knit a baby blanket for my first grandchild. And it's hard to really demonize someone whose wife knit a baby blanket for your grandson.
Nevertheless,
I was able to do it.
Things are so divided now in America, yeah, and in government, in the Senate, in the House. Do you feel like it's possible now for you to have friendly relations with people in government who are, like 180 degrees away from you on politics, on science, on climate change?
Oh, man, there is stuff going on in the EPA right now on science where they're just getting rid of the scientific boards that oversee the science And it's really awful. It's really, this administration does not believe in science, it seems. But there are people in the administration whom I like. I like Sonny Perdue, the ag secretary. And, you know, some of these politicians, they're politicians, successful politicians for a reason and for good reasons. And as far as my Senate colleagues, it's not only do I think it's possible to have good relations with them, it's absolutely necessary. Because there's a lot of stuff that happens that is legislation and appropriations and things that happen that really aren't that partisan. And you need to work with other people. So you need to be a good colleague.
Do you think that President Trump is affecting the way things are being done in the Senate or how people are relating to each other in the Senate?
Well, I think there is an interesting dynamic going on. A colleague of mine, a Republican colleague, was asked by someone at an event right after Trump came into office, like, are Democrats angry? He said, yes, Democrats are angry. Republicans are angry and scared. And I think that my Republican colleagues are frightened by what Trump will do all the time. And I think they see that his base is staying with him, so they don't abandon him. And I think they should have spoken up for a special prosecutor before. They just didn't. I think they've been afraid to do that because the base is their base. And most of my colleagues, most of them live in states where the only one who really beat them is a Republican in a primary, and they don't want to be primaried and lose. They want to keep their job. So I think they're very nervous about this president, and they say so, frankly, behind closed doors or, you know, in private discussions.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean,
in private discussions with you, Republicans confess that?
Yeah. I mean, it's clear that this guy, you know, is just outside the norm in many ways. And that rightly frightens and makes nervous all of us.
So are you concerned that anything you've written in your book is going to be held against you the way the bestiality comedy thing was? You know, because so many I've read a lot of political memoirs and...
I like the way you said it. I've read a lot of political memoirs.
Most political memoirs, if I can generalize for a moment, are very, shall I say, circumspect. And
I think they're very calculated.
Yeah, calculated, often dry, and, you know, with, like, talking
but
points.
But mine, Terry...
Yes. No, but yours is
very
really funny, and it actually is very entertaining. And I think, you know, whether anyone agrees with you politically or not, like, a joke is a joke and funny is funny.
And it's honest, don't you think?
It's the most brilliant book I've ever read, I'm pretty
sure. There we got
it.
Oh, man, we got our quote.
but
that's
seriously.
I'm going. I'm leaving. That was the whole purpose of
it. Since the beginning of the book is about how you were afraid to be funny when you started in politics because you needed people to take you seriously and to believe that you could actually do the job. So you allow yourself to be really funny in the book. And to tell things about yourself that some other politicians might not want to divulge. I mean, let's put it this way. Like, this was years ago, but Bill Clinton had to say he inhaled. And you worked on Saturday Night Live where everybody was doing drugs. You know, so do you fear that anything in the book is going to be either misinterpreted or held against you? We'll leave the Ted Cruz thing aside because I don't want to get into that. Mm-hmm. I don't want to take up time with that.
Sure.
So are you, outside of the Ted Cruz thing, concerned that things in the book will be held against you and will hurt you politically?
I'm sure that things will, I mean, again, this will be put through the new dehumorizer. And you know, people on the right will do that. I think the people of Minnesota, first of all, I think they'd enjoy this book. And they will. I think that so much of my stuff was taken out of context that they kind of saw that in the first race, and then they saw that I wasn't what I was depicted at. And, you know, I feel like the people of Minnesota know who I am.
Senator Al Franken, thank you so much for coming back to Fresh Air. It's great to talk with you again.
Oh, it's always great to talk to you and to listen to you.
Oh, thank you.
Well, you want me to say your radio show is brilliant. No, you can use
You're
that.
Returning
you
the favor. Yes.
Yes.
Now I have a blurb. Okay, now I got it. Thank you.
Sure. Thanks.
Al Franken's new memoir is called Al Franken, Giant of the Senate. I was really excited when I heard David Sedaris had a new book because it meant I had an excuse to talk with him again. He's best known for his stories based on the journals he's kept. His new book actually collects his journal entries from 1977 through 2002. It's called Theft by Finding. It includes the entry from the day Ira Glass called him to let him know that Morning Edition wanted to broadcast Sedaris' Santaland Diaries, his account of working as an elf in Macy's Santaland. That was the broadcast that changed Sedaris' life by giving him a large audience, an audience that demanded to hear more. When Ira started his show This American Life in 1995, Sedaris became a regular contributor. There's many other life-changing moments in these journal entries about friendships, deaths, alcohol and drugs, sobriety, and meeting the man who became his boyfriend. They're still together. But there are also entries that give readers a sense of what Sedaris' daily life has been like over the years and how it's changed over the different phases of his life. And his life has changed a lot. Now he's an internationally known best-selling author. When the book starts, he's a college dropout making a living by picking fruit. David Sedaris, welcome back to Fresh Air. I'm so excited to be able to talk with you again. But before we talk, and there's so much I want to talk with you about, before we talk, I want you to do a short reading from the introduction to your new book of diaries.
I'd be happy to. The early years, 1977 to 1983, were the bleakest. I was writing my diaries by hand back then. The letters were small and fueled by math. A typical entry would go on for pages, solid walls of words, and every last one of them complete crap. I've included very little of that time in this book. It's like listening to a crazy person. The gist is all you need, really. The diary lightened up when I moved to Chicago, partly because I was in a big city, but mainly because I felt so much better about myself. I'd finally done what I'd talked about doing for so many years. I'd left the town I grew up in. I'd gone back to college and actually graduated. There was all the more reason to feel good when, in the fall of 1990, I moved to New York. I was only writing at night back then, either smashed or getting there. You'd think I'd have addressed my drinking, at least in the privacy of my diary, but it's rarely mentioned. To type that word, alcoholic, would have made it real. So I never recounted the talking to's I got from Hugh and certain helpful people in my family. Similarly, it took me a while in the 1970s to write the word gay. Oh, please, I said out loud to my 20-year-old self while reading my earliest diaries. Who do you think you were kidding? This project made evident all the phases I've gone through over the years and how intensely.
That's David Sedaris reading from the introduction to his new book, Theft by Finding, which is a collection of his diaries from 1977 to 2002. David, why did you decide to publish your journals as opposed to stories based on your journals?
Well, when I was in college probably in 1986, I was in a painting critique. And in a painting critique, you'd put up your work and you'd talk about it. And one of the things I noticed pretty early on in art school was that my classmates had no notion of an audience, right? I mean, growing up with the mother that I did, I learned that when you walk into the dry cleaners, there's an audience waiting for you. You know, maybe it's just the person behind the counter, or maybe there are two other customers, but that is your audience. When you go to the grocery store, your audience is waiting. But the people in my class had no sense of that. And so they would talk the way you might talk to a therapist. And it was really boring. So I thought, well, I don't really have that much to say about my paintings. So I'm just going to read a little something. So I read some things from my diary, and it wasn't higgledy-piggledy. I mean, it was stuff that I thought would be funny. And I took this, and I connected it to this, and connect, you know, And I read for like 2 minutes. And people laughed. And then the teacher said, so do we talk about that in connection to your work? And I said, no, I'm done. And then people liked me even more because it meant they could talk about themselves sooner. So I started reading from my diary back then. And when something would work, I would put it into a file that said, that was called a diary that works. So I really probably after my second or third book came out, I thought, you know, one day I'll publish that diary that works file. And it just seemed like the time. But then my editor said, well, why don't you go back and go back to the very beginning and find things that aren't necessarily funny and put those in as well. And soon those outweighed the funny ones, and the funny ones seemed almost overproduced, so I got rid of a lot of them. So this wasn't the book that I had in my mind.
So also in the reading that you just did, you mentioned that you did a lot of your writing on meth. And it made me think about, because there was a period of your life when you were doing a lot of drugs. You had to buy those drugs. And knowing that there's a part of you who is so interested in other people, who sees like the world as kind of like a stage. Do you know what I mean? Not necessarily one for you to perform on, but like you're in the audience and you're watching people behave, and you seem to find like going to a grocery store the night before Thanksgiving and watching people kind of panic buying is great entertainment for you. So when you had to buy drugs from dealers, I don't know if you got them from friends or if you had to like, you know, meet strangers on the street or in the car or in the park or whatever. Did it expose you to people who were like really maybe a little frightening, but also like really interesting to you? And were you yourself, or did you become somebody else around them?
Well, often, you know, when you need drugs and you don't have a lot of money, what you'll do is you'll hang out with people who will give you drugs, right? Mm-hmm. And they're a lot, quite often, they're not people who you would like under any circumstances, but you drop by their house and you laugh at all their jokes and you wait for them to pull the drugs out. And you say things like, God, I haven't gotten high since this morning. And you drop little hints, and then you hate yourself for dropping the little hints. And you pick up a bong and you say, what's this? As if you've never seen a bong. And you sit there and you just... That was the greatest thing about giving up drugs, is that I didn't have to hang out with those people anymore. It wasn't their fault. I was the phony. I was the one who was just hanging out with them for that reason. And often they're people just with crummy personalities, and they couldn't really have friends any other way. They needed the drugs, or no one would hang out with them. So, yeah, I've wasted a lot of time pretending to be interested in people who weren't terribly interested. Then there were really interesting drug dealers, you know, really adventurous, who seemed like little stars to me, you know, had been arrested and hiding drugs inside their body.
So there's another entry I want you to read. And I'm asking you to read this with some reservations because I mentioned in this, and it's part of the reason why I want you to read it, and it's part of the reason why I feel awkward asking you to read it. But I have a really serious question about this that I want to ask you after you're done reading it. So would you read this entry from your journals, David?
Sure. February 16th, 1988, Chicago. Reasons to live. 1, Christmas. 2, the family beach trip. 3, writing a published book. 4, seeing my name in a magazine. 5, watching C grow bald. 6, Ronnie Redrick. 7, seeing Amy on TV. 8, other people's books. 9, outliving my enemies. 10, being interviewed by Terry Gross on Fresh Air.
So as I was telling you before we started the interview, reading that made me feel so honored and like, oh, like I won the David Sedaris Award. But it also made me worried because the headline on that entry is Reasons to Live, and I really didn't know how to interpret that. Was that like, oh, things to look forward to in life? Or did it mean reasons not to kill yourself? I wasn't sure how to interpret Reasons to Live.
It was reasons not to kill myself. You know, I mean, there are certain people in my life who didn't care to be in this book. And so I cut them out. And I had broken up with somebody, and I was you know, really upset and depressed. And so that was, you know, reasons to keep going.
Is it something you were just toying? Like, how serious were you?
I don't, generally I find that when people kill themselves, they have something else going on. You know, like you might break up with somebody or you might declare bankruptcy and you might think that you're going to kill yourself and you might be terribly upset and you might not be able to sleep. But generally speaking, people who kill themselves have something else going on.
Do you mean like depression or some like mental health issue?
Right.
Well, in terms of being interviewed on Fresh Air many times since then.
I was working at that point in my life. I was mainly doing odd jobs and refinishing woodwork in people's houses. And so I would listen to your show. And I wrote about it a lot in my diary. I wrote about
Anita
O'Day.
Anita
when
O'Day,
you
not,
interviewed her.
Not having a uvula, so she didn't have vibrato. Yeah.
And also, when you interviewed her, she said, the name's O'Day. That's Pig Latin for money, honey, and plenty of it. I mean, I don't know if she was drinking during the interview or whatever, but it was completely captivating. But I don't know. I just wanted something so bad. You know, I just wanted to. I really don't think anybody wanted to be somebody more than me. I really don't think anybody could have wanted it more.
When you wanted to be somebody, what were you picturing? Like what kind of somebody?
I was picturing exactly the life that I have today. Exactly the life that I have. And going to a bookstore like I saw, you know, Richard Ford and Tobias Wolff go to bookstores and having people be there and being in the New Yorker and being on the radio. And, you know, I wasn't asking for the world. I thought I was being reasonable. I mean, it seemed like it was possible to talk to you. it wasn't like, oh, I have to be the president. But there were certain things that I wanted. I recently saw that movie La La Land on a plane.
Mm-hmm.
And it made me think about people who didn't have dreams, who didn't, you know, and there are plenty of people I know in my life who, I don't mean to suggest in any way that they're failures, but I don't know that they ever wanted things, you know, like were very specific about what it was that they wanted. Maybe they didn't know what they want. A lot of people don't know what they want, you know, or they're just kind of vague about it. But I was never vague. I knew exactly what I wanted. That doesn't mean you're going to get it, but it's scary. Like in that list, it's scary to put that list together because what if that doesn't happen? If that doesn't happen, then I've announced what I wanted and then I didn't get what I wanted and then I'm a failure. And the way that I grew up, like that word, I heard that word a lot, you know? I heard it a lot, and it was just always right there waiting for me.
Because your parents assumed you'd be one?
Well, not my mom so much, but, you know, my father. I mean, yeah. So it was scary it's always scary to announce what you want, even to yourself, because if you don't get it. The only thing on that list is I see outliving my enemies, and I don't really remember who they were.
That's good. I think that is good. So now that you have the life that you wanted and that you are somebody in that sense, you know, with quotation marks around it, is the life what you expected it to be?
It is fantastic, I have to tell you. It is everything that I thought it would be. Like, I don't want people to think that then you get it and you get tired of it or you think, oh, it wasn't what I wanted. It's exactly what I thought it would be. It's exactly what I want. That said, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, that's very nice. And I'm on a book tour and, you know, and I get to stay in nice hotels. But when I go home, I mean, I spend between, depending on the weather, 5 to 9 hours a day picking up trash on the side of the road. And that's what I do. There's not a day off. I do it 7 days a week. I picked up so much trash on the side of the road that I was invited to Buckingham Palace.
You were invited to Buckingham? I know they named a trash truck after you. You were invited to, like, Wow, because you're picking up trash. And just to put this in context, you live in, was it West Sussex, England?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And there's hills around you, but people throw stuff out of their car all the time. And so your thing is picking up trash. And you used to clean houses for a living back in the Santa Land Diaries era. So it kind of continues something you've always done. And you've always wanted to do outdoor work during the day. So it just kind of... or some kind of work during the day. So it fits a pattern in your life, that's for certain. But wow, Buckingham Palace. Might you become like Sir David Sedaris? Not for your writing, but because you're picking up trash?
Well, the Queen has a day when she invites do-gooders. Because I thought it was going to be me and Hugh and the Queen. And I got there and there were 8,000 do-gooders.
Oh,
and some of them were cancer research, or some of them were... work preserving buildings. And so I didn't meet the Queen. I stood like 6 feet away from her. That was enough for me. So it's Buckingham Palace. We're in the gardens behind Buckingham Palace. And they served these, they had tea and sandwiches and, you know, served on silver plates. And then somebody came around with a tray and offered ice creams. And the ice creams were in little cardboard containers, right? And then I saw people finish their ice cream and then think, I'll just put the empty in this planter. I'll just hide it behind this column. And they were littering at the Queen's house.
That's great. And you didn't pick it up, though,
seeing.
Right? You didn't take it on yourself to.
And that was my day off.
Oh, okay. So March 21st, 1991, you write, "This spring, I am, if I'm not mistaken, in love." Had you been in love like that before with somebody who reciprocated?
Yes, I was in love once before. But it was a little bit different. It was a little bit different with Hugh because Hugh didn't seem to be... didn't have his one eye on me and the other eye looking around for someone else,
mm-hmm.
You know? And that made all the difference in the world.
November.
He seemed happy with just me.
November 1st, 1991, you move in with Hugh. Then November 14th, 2 weeks later, your mother dies. Two momentous things happening within 2 weeks of each other. One wonderful and one terrible. I'd like you to read some of your entry from November 14th, 1991.
Sure. November 14th, 1991, Raleigh. Mom died last night, suddenly of pneumonia, brought on by her chemotherapy. Amy called to tell me, and now we're all in Raleigh. Dad gave us the option of seeing her laid out at the funeral home, but I was afraid to go. We all were. How strange to be in her house and see her things, the half-worked crossword puzzle, her mail and stockings. She didn't expect to die yesterday, did she? When it happened, Hugh and I were in our kitchen in New York. He was making manicotti and talking about a wooden chicken he'd bought when I was socked by the weirdest feeling. I thought that Hugh was going to die, and I must have said something because he accused me of being dramatic. I can't believe this has happened.
Do you feel like you felt a premonition of your mother's death?
I'm not one to be like that, but I did. I mean, normally I don't talk like that, you know, like I don't say things like, oh, I sensed it happening.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's probably once in my, you know, you get deja vu every now and then. I don't get it, you know, weekly or anything. I probably get it, you know, once every 3 years like a normal person. But yeah, I just felt like something just happened. Something's wrong.
I'm just so moved when you write, she didn't expect to die yesterday, did she? That things were still in process in her life, the unfinished crossword puzzle.
She got pneumonia from the chemotherapy, and mm-hmm. So she couldn't breathe, and so she was rushed to the hospital. And right. So that was how she died.
When you were deciding to write about your mother's death, how did you decide what to write or what to finally publish in this book about it?
Gosh, well, you know how, like, when people get sick sometimes, you don't want to acknowledge that they're sick because that seems to be, I don't know, like with my mother, like I would have loved to have said like, oh, you're going to die, and so can I come and spend time with you? Can I come and hang out with you? Can we, let's talk about all these things that we meant to talk about, because that's suggesting that she'll die. And so maybe the best thing to do is when they say, like, I'm going to die, you say, no, you're not. You're going to be fine. You're going to be fine. Like, I think about David Rakoff, you know, the last time I saw David, I mean, he looked awful.
And he was a close friend of yours who was a wonderful writer.
He died 5 years ago. He had Hodgkin's lymphoma in it years ago, and then he had radiation and for it, and then the radiation caused a new kind of cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And when I last saw him, I just said, all right, I'll see you later. Like, and I knew I would never see him later, but it just seemed like if I had said more than that, it was just burdening him. It was just, he was so brave, and who was I to suggest that he wouldn't get better?
My impression is maybe that you were trying to let David Rakoff and your mother let you know if they were ready to talk about impending death, as opposed to you telling them that it was impending. You were waiting for them to tell you, and if they didn't, you were going to play it their way.
Right. That's just what I've always done. You're right.
How did your mother's death change your relationship with your father?
Well, my mother always really liked me. I feel very fortunate to have been loved by my mother. And so you know how it can be in a family, right? And so it really bothered my father. And I would come home and my mother would make me exactly what I wanted for dinner, and she would serve me first. And my father would just be furious and take it out on me. It was like a game that they, you know, I mean, I wasn't the only one, you know, that this was going on with. But, you know, you grow up with it and it just becomes normal to you. And after my mother died, then I could have a different relationship with my dad. But, you know, the relationship did change with my dad. But it wasn't like, you know, with my mother, it was just effortless. You know, just you never thought, oh, what are we going to talk about in the car? You know, you just are talking in the car. It was physical. If mom's there, you just wrap your, you know, you just kind of throw yourself on her, you know, like hang off of her. Just, I always considered myself very, very lucky to have had her as a mother.
So I haven't spoken to you in a few years. So the question I really wanted to ask you was, how are you? But I thought, like, well, when people say, how are you, the person responding says, I'm fine, how are you? So I didn't expect it would be a question you could really answer. You know what I mean? But really, like, how are you?
I am tanned. I just went to the beach house, and that was my goal.
This is the house you bought for you and your family in a beach off of North Carolina where you used to vacation.
Yes, we bought a house on the on an area called Emerald Isle. We bought a house, and the houses there all have names. And so our house is called the C-section. That's what we named it.
Right, against your
C-section
father's wishes.
For the long weekend, and I got a tan because I wanted a tan for my book tour.
Oh.
So I am tanned, and often when I go on tour, I'll get up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom, and then every anxiety I have just jumps me.
Mm-hmm.
And I say, get him. And then I just lay there awake for the rest of the night.
Uh-huh.
And so I got up, I don't know, like at 4 o'clock in the morning, and they said, get him. And I said, there's nothing to get. I mean, I'm sorry, but I don't. I mean, I could be anxious like, oh, is my alarm going to go off at 8? But I don't have that. I was dreading going on television for the book tour, but I already finished that. So I really I have a tan, and I have nothing to be anxious about. So I'm delighted.
David, I have so enjoyed talking with you again. Thank you so much for coming back to the show. Congratulations on the book. It's just absolutely fascinating to read it. So,
thank you so much, Terry, for having me back on.
David Sedaris' new book, Collecting His Journals from 1977 to 2002, is called Theft by Finding. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Heidi Simon. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Teresa Madden, Mooj Zaidi, and Thea Chaloner. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. I'm Terry Gross.